intervention happening in Joburg also, that is actually the reason why those officers are here. They were invited by the civilian police secretary for that. So thank you very much.
Thanks very much, Mr. Bühler. And there, I thought that you were coming just to speak to us. But I'm very pleased that you're packing a lot into your program. Can I just, as an opening remark, say that Mr. Egger and Mr. Breitner, you are most welcome, and we really welcome you. We have a very close relationship with Bavaria, as you know. We had a committee visit there last year, and we really did enjoy it. Earlier this year, was it? Earlier this year? Last year? And it really was an eye-opener. But your visit coincides also, as you know, with the releasing of the national crime statistics yesterday. And I just want to say that the release of those statistics for any civilized person would have been seen as being a disaster for both the country and this province. And irrespective of one's political persuasion, these statistics are unacceptable and a grave threat not only to our ordinary people and communities, but also to the fundamentals of an orderly and constitutional state. Tragically, ours is a country where one can visit and enjoy great beauty and hospitality in one area and in perfect safety, while just a few kilometers away, fear and criminality, often leading to death, is a daily part of life. We have to use every tool at our disposal to combat the scourge, and crime analysis is one such tool. So we look forward to your presentation, and again, you're welcome. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for the invitation, and it's really a great honor to talk, to speak to you here in this parliament. Well, what we want to talk about is trust. Maybe it's a little bit, you think it's a surprise talking about trust. There are so many problems, trust within the police, but we want to show you in our brief presentation how we think how important trust is for the police work. Of course, we know it's a completely different situation here. We did know it before, but when we visited Kalitsa, we see it's different. Informal settlement, everything is completely different in German. But still, I think the police, however the circumstances are, the goal of police is always to make a safer environment. And if we look, of course, to the statistics, there is things to do to make it safer. The same thing in Germany, it's a very political thing. The police stats is very political. We have elections right now, and you might have heard about our situation, about migration, about the discussion, about the crime rates, and this is the top theme about the election in October as well. So policing is always a very political thing, especially when it comes to the statistics and to elections. So why do we need trust with police? Because we are in the middle of the society, and if people don't trust us, they don't work with us. And without the people, we can't create a safe environment. And this is one point, like the clearing rate of crime. If we have a low clearing rate, there is no trust in our work. So this is one thing we have to really take care of, that the clearing rate, that our main topic, clear crime, is very important to gain trust. So we split it off the agenda in four topics: targets of good police work, the value of preconditions for trust building, how do we gain trust, and then we will look a brief look how we do this in the grassroots, in the police station in Munich. Well, we see it if it comes to statistics, but not just with the crime statistic. Safety is the most important thing for people, for their life. Without safety, there is almost nothing, anything else. Even, of course, here, the job, the poverty is a big topic, but even if you have a job and if you have your income, if you cannot be sure that somebody takes it away, it doesn't help a lot. So safety is also here very important. And the last survey in Germany, 2017, you can see that here, that it was the highest priority of the people there. Okay, and what is the role of the police in this whole thing about safety? We have to enforce the law. Of course, this is a has always been like this, but we also have to prevent crime. Like a crime, we clear is not as good for the people as a crime which doesn't happen, which we can't prevent. And this is even in the police law. It's our goal to enforce law and to prevent crime. And we have a separate law for that, and we are completely independent from the justice system. That's the police matter to prevent law. And then, of course, we need...
Prevent crime.
And then we need the responsibilities. We have to be part of a lot of institutions to make a safer environment, and that has to be clear for everybody. And so what are the benefits of a trustful work? More confidence in the police work, then people come to the police. We have, of course, the higher crime clearing rate if we get more information from the people, and we have less street crime. And also something, if we are a trustful organization, we are very attractive for people who want to become a policeman. I come to that later, but this is a very important thing. We need good staff, good people working for the police. That's the most important thing we can have. So what are the preconditions? Of course, we need good laws. We have this in, as far as I know, we have the best laws here in South Africa. We have good laws in Germany. That's not the problem. We need good staff, good educated staff, very good educated staff, because there is police work is one of the most complicated things. It's much more complicated than other things, because the reason of crime is so complex. So you have to understand more than to carry a weapon or to be physically strong. Then, of course, we need resources. We do need resources. And then we need partners. We are only part of this whole story about a safe community and a safe environment. We need partners, and it has to be clear that we need partners. We can't work in silos. And this happens very often. There are different responsibilities, but we do work in silos. And very often, if you are on meetings, everybody says, yes, but. We have to work together, and it has to be clear, not just on the paperwork, on the law. We really have to do that. And that's not often very, very easy, because we have not always had the trust we need to do that. And we had a long time. It took us, after the Second World War, it took us 40, 50 years really to become a police, being within the community, being accepted and very trusted for many different reasons. One reason is because we have seen that we need not just organizations and law, we need guidelines, and we need a philosophy. It must be clear that we are there not for the government, it must be clear that we are there for the people. And people do feel that. And in early ages, police was very often there for the government, to keep the power of the government. It must be clear that we are there for the people, not for the government. We have to enforce the law, and we have to be there for the people. And we have to communicate that. People have to know that they are there for them. And we have to be part of the community. So we have to be not like in a separate thinking area. We have to think with the people on a daily basis. And we have to treat victims and perpetrators, maybe it's the wrong term, not like partners, but like one person of the whole thing. Without working together with perpetrators, we can't get a whole a safe environment, because they are there. They are there. So we have to make the best out of it. So we only function if we have really a philosophy. And I always try to describe by myself what makes a philosophy, or what does it make in a daily basis. I'd say it's like part of a culture, police culture. And what is culture? For me, culture is what policeman does at night when nobody sees it. Yeah. If I can like explain it like this. And for this, training and education is the basis for everything. And we divided this in three competences: the field competences, acting competences, and most important, social and personal competences. While the field competences, we have it really in the first part of the education, not just theory. We really train situations. We have 30, 40 prepared situations, and policemen train it. In in an environment they can do it, and then when they are outside, they know exactly what to do. The same is with the acting competence. You don't just need to know how it works, but you have to be sure that you are able to do this. And that's how we, because it's not just a physical thing, we have to act with the people. The social and personal competence is for us one of the most important thing, and this is of course something when we hire people, when we recruit people, it's the most important thing, that's our most focus, how are these social and personal competences, and you can measure this social and personal competences, and then we are going on to strengthen it in their education. And of course part of the stuff is leadership, and we have the philosophy that our leaders have to come from within the police, and it takes a long time to become a leader. I showed you there on a screen, we have three different levels, and regularly mostly you start at the very first level on the blue side. You visit police school for 2 years, then you have a practical year, and you stay 3 years at this police force who is responsible for the education. And then you go into the field, and then you have a chance, if you have good marks, if you get, if you do good, if a good job, and you're always evaluated, all the time you are evaluated, you get a chance to get the police academy after a test. Again, the test, if I choose somebody, then you still have to do a test on your social skills, even if you are in the police for 5 or 6 years. Then you do the police academy for another 2 years, and then you are in the middle ranks, this is the middle management, but you also work in the field. Then another 5 years working there, get good marks, good evaluation. You can apply for a program, you get chosen for a program, this is a 2-year program. You work in this 2 years in 4 different police stations, 4 different police chiefs look at you, you get from these 4 different stations, you get marks. And if your marks are good enough, you get to go in an assessment center. In the assessment center, 50% from all this way succeed, only 50%, the other 50% don't succeed. And this 50%, they get the chance to get the university, police university, another 2 years. And then you are on the golden side, and then you can make your way up to president. We are now on a 4-star level, and we started at the very bottom. The idea behind that is policing has very much to do with experience, and if you do not know what's going on in the street, you really, it's very difficult to make the right decision, to make the right structures, the right strategies, because you have to have a feeling and you have to know what's going to happen in the street. For example, we work very closely together with prosecutors. Prosecutors come from the university directly to the office, and they get our paperwork. And very often they don't understand why is it like this, why did it happen like this. And for example, I was responsible for the drug unit for a while. There were all the young prosecutors, and I figured they should get in the street with us. And we offered them go with us in the street for 4 weeks, and after that they were a completely different view on our work, because they knew what's at 4 o'clock in the morning, if you have to go in an apartment, or if you have like somebody with a weapon in front of you, or the fear they could have a weapon. So this is from our perspective very important, that we have experienced police leaders who understand crime, who understand the work in the street, and who understand their stuff. If I'm always just sitting in the office, I don't understand what it's going to be if I have a 12-hour shift and stuff like this. If I'm away from my family, like on the weekends, we do have to understand this. And this is the reason we have this in place, and we think it's a pretty good system.
Maybe to put this also in perspective, maybe to put this into perspective to other administrations within the government, for example, where I work, we come straight from the university and can enter the highest level, right? But within the police, it's not possible. So also, I think it's quite challenging to ride through the ladders within the police compared, for example, to my profession, where you just go to university, and after university, if you have good marks, you can enter government. That's not possible in the police. And that's very special in Bavaria, I have to say. Also very challenging for the police officers, by the way.
So with this system, we did gain trust. If you see this survey, we are the highest trusted institution in Germany right now. And even if we had growing problems the last 3 years, even so, the police gained 6% more on trust. And if you see in the next, the most attractive employee is the police right now. And this is very good for us because we can choose them, the people. We can choose the people we want. There is another survey that says we are only in second place. First place is become a professional soccer player. Coming into some details, how we can gain trust and how important it is. Let's look at the victim. If the victim doesn't trust us, why would you want to go to the police? If they just say, well, then I'm in another trouble. They have to trust us, they have to know what we do, and then they come, and then we get the information about crime. Sometimes if the crime rate rises, it doesn't mean the situation is worse. Maybe we get some information from the dark field. You know, if I'm more trustful, if I look into a thing more, I get higher numbers. That doesn't mean the situation is worse. It means I know more about crime, maybe. And for example, we have to have solution. If it comes to domestic violence, the victim has to be in the focus of your thinking, not the perpetrator. Police usually thinks about the perpetrator. I only need the victim for a witness and then forget the victim. And the perpetrator is my focus because I want to clear the crime, to solve the crime. If it comes to domestic violence, we have to get a turnaround and put the victim in our focus. And for that, we have like a Victim Protection Act with a lot of possibilities. For example, even it's written down how we work together with NGOs and that we have to work together. And meanwhile, it's very well improved. 30 years ago, it was very difficult for us to work, for example, with social workers. Now we work like a team. We do have special officers for crime victims. It's just an overview with all kind of institutions. They work together and they are specially educated. And then of course you can't be everywhere at the same time. Police has always limited resources, so risk assessment is very important. Professional risk assessment. Know the situation and then put the right strategies in place. And for that we have and we still improving a really professional risk assessment, which we don't do just by ourselves. We do it with different specialists, with psychologists, with doctors, with different people from the medical system, with the government, with the local government, with specialists in the different fields. For example, like if you look at weapons are a big risk, think about what could you do about weapons. I heard like 40% of the murders are with weapons. So we don't just think at the murders, we think at the weapons, what we could do. Like in the States, everybody thinks I'm safe if I have a weapon. They have 30,000 dead people because of weapons. So maybe if you look, have a deeper look, it doesn't create safety, it does create a lot of harm if many people have weapons, even the legal weapons they have there. Same thing with the witness. The witness is crucial for us. If a witness just gets in trouble, if you witness a crime at the police, why would you go to the police? Why would you take yourself into danger? For this, we have general witness protection, and we do have, at the end, a high risk, like a Witness Protection Act, where we even can relocate somebody on high risk cases. We can give them a new identity, but that's not the normal thing. The normal thing is that we just protect them at the court and so on. Maybe we don't give their name. Maybe we have. Normally you have to go to court. We have the possibility that they don't have to show up. They just have a thing, or we tape their testimony and bring it to court, stuff like possibilities like this. And then the third, which for me is the most important, how I treat the suspect, how I treat the offender. The offender is one part of society, and if we want or not, he's there, and he will be there for a long time, and even if we take him in prison, the resocialization is a big part, but it's not all offenders go to prison. So if I handle him fair as a people, first of all, as a person, first of all, I respect the human rights, which is also very, it's our basis. And on the other hand, I create trust. I have a calculation here. we have, it was from 2 years ago, but it's always the same. We have 300,000 offenders committing 600 something offenses a year in Bavaria. And we all know that very many young people are a great risk to do one offense or two when they're young, but that's it. And the day, how we treat this, when they are, it's very, they are in a very weak situation, when they are offend the first time at the police, young guys, mostly young guys, how we treat them in this situation, they will remember this all of their life, because maybe this is the only contact with the police. And if we treat them like this, they will, I decide in this day or these 2 days, will he be a friend of the police? Will he trust the police? Even if I'm a perpetrator, they handle me fair, or will say, this is not my police. And if you look at the numbers, that from 300,000, maybe 250,000 committing one crime in their life. And then you have the chance in this couple days or couple hours to lead them towards the trust of the police or not. And if you look at them, 250,000, they have a family, they have friends, and this, let's say, a million people are within the police, in contact with the police as an offender or as a friend or family offender. You decide in this couple hours, do you lose a million people a year, or do they say, well, even if I made a mistake, this is the police, they handled me fair, and I trust this police, even if you are an offender. And coming from the law enforcement to the crime prevention, which is also our main goal, it's as important as law enforcement, of course. We have different possibility. Just to mention some, the offender-oriented. We go to schools, we go to kindergartens, not come, that they see this is my police, I can ask them, I can trust them, I can touch them, I don't have a fear from the police. This is this part. On the other hand, we have really high-risk perpetrators. This is also prevention. We go there and we say, well, we know you are a threat for your family, you are a threat for this area. You didn't commit offense, but we assess you are dangerous, and we observe you, and we will be there if you do something. So this is a two wide ranges, from prevention coming to a person, or avoiding situations. Many possibilities of avoiding situations coming, talking about domestic violence. We take the people away from the place they live. We help them to start a new life somewhere else if they are under threat. Or we trust our presence, or we have CCTVs. So many different things. And then the social control. Do people feel responsible for the area? Do they look at when things happen? Do they tell this to police? And the more trust they have, the more they are in the social control thing and say, well, I feel responsible and somebody helps me and I go to the police. So this is just a couple ideas about our crime prevention. We do have a crime prevention unit, a central crime prevention unit who provides strategies, ideas, materials into the field, because every policeman in the street is part of a prevention program. Even if I talk to somebody in a nice manner, it's part of a crime prevention program. And for all that, we need crime analysis to know where we have to go, to know what we do, to know our strategies. If I see now 30,000 murders, if I know that, that's nothing I can really act on. I have to go deeper. I don't, why are they becoming murder, where it's going, happening, what's the deeper thing, what kind of tools do they use, and so on. Then I can build a strategy, and for that I have to have a crime analysis unit with specialists, and I have to really do deep crime analysis, that I know what to do and where to go. And this ends, or this comes to strategic analysis. This is like for politicians, for decision makers, for us to make like plans, not just react. We have to act on a strategic basis. We do tactical analysis, same thing. This is also action, not just reaction, sometimes reaction, but also action, and then operative analysis. And on that, which is very important, that we share it with other stakeholders. We don't hide our information and just give it out if we don't have another chance. We share it all the time to all the stakeholders who are also responsible, because we are the only one who have this information. But we have a lot of people who are responsible for safety. So it's very important that we share it. And this again gives us trust if we really share our problems, our information, our data, they have to be valid, of course. And if we share this, this gives us a lot of trust. And this gives the other stakeholders the possibility to work on it. And one little thing, a pretty new thing about crime analysis is to identify people, because at the end of the day we have all this information, but at the end of the day I want to identify people. And new traces now, because in the net, because of the smartphones, are faces. For example, we have a lot of people, they come, this is a suspect who assaulted me or something, and he has a photo on his smartphone. And we were working on it, and we pretty have it in place to be able to identify these people from the picture. We can go with one picture in a big database from over 5 million pictures and identify these people if they are convicted offenders. Then we can identify those people. And with this I come to the beginning, we have to have a high clearing rate, otherwise the respect and the trust is not big enough. If we are just nice and talk to everybody and we don't really enforce the law and we are not up to date with everything, we don't gain trust as well. And with that, I come to my final cooperation with partners. It's all about cooperation, and the preconditions for cooperation is everything about trust and everything what's behind trust. And now we will show in a short manner how we do this, like in the grassroots level in the police station.
So I would like to explain why trust building and trust is very important, also very important for me as a station commander and on the police station, and every police station, I think so. That you can imagine where we come from, this is my police station, at the top left, then an aerial view from Munich Schwabing, that's an area where we have a high density of citizens, high population, and in my office we have a headcount of about 200 police officers and civil employees. And the relation from officer to citizens is at the moment about 100 to 429, 430. That looks not bad. That's a good situation. If you see 1 to 430, I'm happy with it. But we cannot be everywhere. It's not possible with 200. We work shifts, so we are not able to look at every place in my area. What to do? So we need others who help us in our work. And therefore, us to have partners is very important. Let me explain with this example. This is an example from Munich. We have at our headquarters nearly 7,000 police employees. They are from 5,000 uniformed police, but they are not always at the station. They have a training, somebody is ill, they make holidays, and so at the end, in maximum, we have 1,000 police officers on the street. But on the other side, we have more than 2 million people. They can help us if they trust us. And they have eyes where they can give their information, suspect situations, they can call us, but they will only call us if they trust us, that we can do, whether we can help. If they think we have no chance to help them, or we say no, we're not interested in, they didn't tell us and call us. And therefore we're looking for partners in different ways to make understandable that we are the most important stakeholder concerning law and crime, avoiding crime, but everybody has to help us, and it's interesting for everybody to have a safe city. And therefore there are many cooperation. For only an example, with the public transport system, we go together with them on patrol to show police is a part. We assist each other. Another point is we have contracts, for example, with the responsible organizations in domestic violence, from the shelter houses, and some else. But the most important partner for us are the citizens, and therefore we do a lot to gain trust in our society. Let me bring some activities. We have in our station, in every station, so-called community liaison officers. I can say these are similar like bobbies. Each of them has a known area of responsibility. They know everybody. The people can contact them in an easy way. They're always on the street and they are visible. And this is very helpful. And they also make crime prevention in their area to give tips, to give some information, what's helpful, what happens. And also they gave us, the other officers, for example, the plainclothes, the search units, information, what could be helpful for us. We do bike patrols to be addressable, better addressable than in the cars. We have a citizen patrol. They help us, similar like a living mobile emergency phone. They call us if police is needed, but they're not police. They're only on the streets, and the citizen can contact them. And we do many other things, trust gaining activities, for example. Bernard explained just before, we have every month two or three groups from kindergartens in our police station to make them understandable that we are not responsible for punishment, that we are not administration for punishment. We are a service institute, and when they need help, they have to come to us and ask and come to a police officer when the children see one of them. And this is very important to start very early to gain trust. And we do it with the in schools, and we do it also with adults that we carry out behavior training, for example. And one point I would explain a little bit more detail, because I'm very proud to have it, and but in my opinion is very successful, are our youth officers. The youth people are the future. And it's very important to have a contact with them. So in every police station in Munich, we have two officers, we call it youth officers. They are normally, they are police officers, but they normally wear plain clothes, and they go to the schools, they go to the places where the young people met each other. They carry out courses in school together with the teacher. This is well structured. They are trained every year, get new information concerning social media, for example, and they have the contact to the teachers but also to the several youth people. And these are young officers, because we think it's important that they understand the behavior and also the speech of the young. And in my opinion, this is a very good point for crime prevention and also for trust gaining. The problem is that trust gaming helps us not to solve the cases. Not directly. It's important to get information. But to solve the cases, we need to know what happened in our police station, the area where we're responsible for. And therefore, we have a daily briefing with all group leaders where we exchange the information. What happened the last 24 hours? What additional information we do get from the headquarters? What anything else happened in the world that has maybe an influence to our station, for example, a terror attack. But we only can make good decisions if we know what happened exactly. So experience is one point that's important for police, but when I said the experience, to understand what happened on the streets, but it's also important to see in detail what crime we have. And therefore, every station has an analyst, it's a police officers who support us for the briefing and makes analysis from my local police station. So we have an analysis at the headquarters, but in additional, in my office, we need more information, more detailed information, and we bring this the information together with the information from our police officers there on the street. And the analyst makes crime mapping, for example. He looks at new modus operandi. He looks what could be happen in our area from outside, what's coming in, and he tries to find out places where police is needed. And on the next sheet you see this is a density map. I said we have not much enough police officers at our station, but we can see where police is needed. And with the analysis I'm able to send the police officers to the area where we have the offenders, where crime happened, and it's much more successful, and we send it all around. You can see, for example, the English Garden, there's no crime, and so, because that, it's not necessary to bring out the resources in the whole area. But there's one point what for me also important is concerning trust. This is the problem that we have to avoid to lose trust. If there is one officer at Munich police or in my station who makes a crime, a bigger crime, for example, drug dealing, to say something, or maybe he's corrupt, he takes money, then he has an influence to all other officers. So it's very important to examine ourselves for me, and how we do that in practice, it's difficult, and it's not a guarantee to find it before it happens, but we can do many efforts to avoid this. For example, are there complaints from citizens against officers? Sometimes it's normal that we have complaints. Not everybody is happy with the activity of the police. But if I have an officer who has 2-3 more complaints, so I think we have to look what happens. We have to look in the several groups. What norms do they have? Is there a problem in this area? What the philosophy of the group leader, for example? The 24-hour shifts, you as a chief, you see them 1-2 times a week, because they are about 24 hours, and not I. And therefore, we have to be very sensitive to see what happened in our station. And if every complaint from the citizens is on my table, and I check it, and I have the feeling, what Bernard says, from the experience from the past, what's behind? You get a feeling if you do it a longer time. And then we decide what to do. Sometimes it's if only the problem with the behavior has a consequence for trust building. They are not happy with us. They're the bad police. So if there's a if we see that, we have to apologize. I write a letter to the citizen and say sorry, that was not correct. And we talk with the officer and we try to solve the problem. For example, we send them to a communication training if necessary. So that's very important, that we don't lose the trust, but again, if we make a good work and we solve the cases. And in my opinion, trust building and trust is the first step to be successful at police work.
Okay, let me summarize this. You also can read it. We had it at the last point. Communication and escalation skills of police officers are crucial to gain trust. Targeted, orientated cooperation with different stakeholders is crucial. Successful enforcement of the law is the best way to gain trust. Trust is a basic element for professional policing and successful policing. And gaining trust is a long-term and never-ending strategy. You just don't just have it and keep it. It's an ongoing daily thing to keep your trust. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Let me just move to my seat. So again, Mr. Brighton, thank you very much for those presentations. Really found them most illuminating and a continuation of what we heard when we visited Bavaria. I'd just like to say, Mr. Brighton, that the statistics of your particular police station, the quantum of the population, police to population ratio, I live in a police precinct which has a similar population, probably another 5,000 more, with half the police officers and 40 murders a year. So I don't know how many murders you have in your precinct, but I doubt very much with it.
Zero.
It's zero. Well, you see, that's a tragedy. And I hear that you're going to go and see the National Commissioner. And but Mr. Egger said right from the start that in order to be able to get to the level of proficiency and professionalism that you are now and the levels of trust, it took you 30, 40, 50 years to do so. We in South Africa are in a completely different dimension at the moment. And I see, and I specifically in the one question that I'd like to lead in with and then ask the other members to ask, is that because we are in such a different dimension as far as criminality in South Africa is concerned as opposed to a sophisticated society like Germany and Bavaria, is that we're going to need certain crisis interventions. I'm not quite sure what they are, but one of the things that I do know is that the investment in the quality of training, of recruitment and training of police officers in order to be able to develop that trust is going to be a critical success factor. Unless we recruit efficiently and do proper assessment, psychometric assessment and physical training and adherence to the rule of law, then we are not going to get anywhere. And one of the ways in which we are going to have to do it is possibly what the military does traditionally, and that is lateral entry, which is what you do a similar sort of thing, but you do it after an extended period. In other words, you do your basic military training, which would be 3 or 6 months, whatever it is, and then you get assessed for leadership capacity, and then you go from there into an academic line. If you've got leadership capacity, then you get inserted in as a leader, a platoon commander, whatever it is. Because one of the big problems that we have at the moment, in order to be work through the ranks of the South African Police Service, you start off as a constable, you work your way up to become a warrant officer after 10 or 12 years or whatever it is, then you become an officer after that. If there's any corruption within that system, you get contaminated within that first 12 years. So by the time you become an officer, you're becoming a corrupt officer or inefficiency. So you need to ensure that you've got academically qualified people getting inserted in at station level to at least manage the shifts and to ensure that administratively there is a capacity taking place, docket handling, shift management, things like that. And I would love to ask you further questions relating to your shift management and so on, because when you see General Sithole, please ask him how the South African Police Service does shift management. It is beyond comprehension that, and it is a key component as to why we don't have people on the task at any one point in time. All right, that's enough from my side. Mr. Mitchell and Mr. Slecker and Mr. Kabida, and I'm sure some others. So let's take those three first.
Thank you, Che. Thank you. Let me first say I welcome the presentation. I was fortunate to see firsthand, so I'm not going to delve into a lot of questions. I just want to understand or ask the allocation for the police of the budget as allocated by the government. What portion of the budget do get allocated to the police? With regards to the youth officers, is there a link between the Department of Education like we know it and the police, or if a school, for argument's sake, says, oh, well, we don't want the youth officers in the school, are they forced to do that? And then also, I didn't see it, but I of previous experience know that or heard that the police is the most desired profession. So you must be doing something right for people to voluntarily want to become police officers. What is the thing that or the enticing or getting especially young people into the police force? And then just lastly, with regards to the, and Chair, you touched on it, but in there's an entire process. It's like a professional system or development program for an individual to ultimately become the police commissioner, like we know it. That process is obviously a very long process. And during that time, is there some sort of, other than just the academic support, is there some sort of like psychological, emotional support that keeps that person in the system? Because I mean, I have lots of respect for police officers. It's not an easy job. So, and I suppose it's all over the world. It's like that. So, is there a constant, like training, emotional, from an EQ side? Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Chair. Chair, let me first welcome the presentation from our visitors. It's so unfortunate that I will be speaking from only the presentation that has been done, as I was not part of the delegation that went to Bavaria, and I think it's important for all of us to get the same experience on our sister partners in exchanging knowledge on issues that are affecting us. Having said that, Chair, I want to start from a point that Germany is one of the wealthiest countries in Europe. That compared to the situation in South Africa that we are at as a developing country. And I would like to check in terms of the, if you're looking at the socio-economic conditions of the communities in South Africa, particularly those that, if you're reading the crime stats released yesterday, the 10 stations in the Cape Flats are areas that are predominantly poor areas. It's poverty-stricken areas, densely from the your urban areas, far away from all resources. And I want to check, is it possible that if you come in such conditions where there's never been or there's not enough investment in terms of upbringing from kindergarten up to a youth stage, what conditions would be prevalent in terms of the outcomes that you get from those areas? And two, Chair, I want to check, if you're looking at the slide number 4, the role of police in the society, and if you're speaking of the enforcing the law, preventing crime, and the responsibility, is that a responsibility of all government departments, or is it solely the responsibility of the police to ensure that there's prevention of crime regardless of the infrastructure that is there? I know there's a problem of infrastructure in Germany, but if you compare that to the situation in Africa, in South Africa particularly, would you think that crime prevention or law enforcement is an abstract from the conditions that the people in the society are living in? Or is it part of a larger community involvement, including the government departments? Then coming to the issues of building trust, I fully agree that when you build trust, You start from the early stages. You don't just say we want to build trust, but you ensure that people from, you know, in our situation, you always, if you're getting children that are kind of not behaving, you will always say, I'm taking you to the police. There's a policeman. I'm going to report you. And immediately, you are instilling fear in those children. So I'm saying, Chair, it's a nice experience to have that trust building at a very early age. The last one, which I think is important, I was born and raised in Nyanga. The number one murder capital. And in the late 90s, early 2000s, there was a project by Quaker Peace Center, funded by the Bavarian government, where you had your peace officers walking the streets of Nyanga, including Old Crossroads. And to the community, to see the visibility of people that are interested in ensuring that there is safer communities. To us, that was a plus one. It did not need the men in blue or the army, because at that time we had the army visible in certain areas. So it did not need those people, because there were community members involved. Would you think that the banning of such a project or the withdrawal of a successful project of that nature impacted on the current situation that Nyanga is unable to swim out of the current situation that it finds itself in. Would there be any other innovative measures like that Quaker Peace Center innovation that was in partnership with the Bavarian government to ensure that communities like Bishop Levenstein Beck, Ravensmead, Nyanga, Khayelitsha, Philippi East are enjoying the fruits of good partnership with other countries? And would that take a government to enter into such a partnership or any other community that wants to ensure that the communities are safer would approach the Bavarian government to facilitate such a process? I thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Chair, and also thanks for the presentation, and I think it gives hope in the first instance, especially after the release of statistics yesterday, to hear a positive story again. That instills hope. We have an advert that's very often broadcast, screened on TV, Coronation is an insurance company, and their logo is "Trust is Earned." And I think this is exactly what is happening in the Bavarian police. Trust is earned. It doesn't come easy. I'm in the education sector, and I'm particularly interested in the way you deal with the educational sphere. I see the easy access that you have. You start right from kindergarten in terms of, this is a primary and secondary socialization, right up to adult education. Now, for me, what is important is that you actually shadow teach. You're actually moving into the curriculum. Not outside, not extracurricular activity, but moving right into the curriculum and also making policing a part of the curriculum and also affecting behavior modification as far as that is concerned. I think that's a brilliant idea. The other issue that I want to touch on very quickly, so it's all about function, your functionality in schools. The other one is, you mentioned, Mr. Egger, that police should belong to more entities and organizations. And I think that's an important point. And not only be stuck to the police station, but not infiltrate, but belong to other community organizations to pick up ground intelligence and to interact more freely with people to supply that. Your interaction with a perpetrator, I think that's moving away from the punitive measures and the sanctioning and more rehabilitation. I think that's also a positive sign in terms of, it's more or less in line with our VOD, victim offender dialogue, and seeing which way you can turn around the table. The last point I want to make, the glaring difference, I may be wrong, when it comes to the philosophy that you spoke, in terms of carrying that philosophy or methodology over to the citizens and say, we are working for you, we are the servants of you, we are the servants of the people there together. That is wonderful. That's how it should be. So then that builds trust. We are not working for the government, but your security is of prime importance. In the South African scenario, unfortunately, And I'm not casting any aspersions. I'm just telling the truth. Yes? And he said, vigilance, or the lack of vigilance, as far as I'm concerned, is the most important problem or challenge in our country. We had a break-in. I'm living in a safety complex. We had a break-in on Saturday. They came past the security gate, past the booms. How they came in, nobody knows. But this is how it happens. And in making a concluding remark, I think this is when trust is absent. When trust is absent and people, the citizens don't trust the police and the police don't trust the citizens, and then we find this type of problem. Thank you so much. Okay. Thank you, Chair.
All right, I'm going to ask our guests to respond, but colleagues, I must ask, please, we were very short on questions. There are lots on our contribution, which is important, but our guests have to leave by 10 o'clock and they've got to get to Johannesburg. So can I ask if you could just answer those questions that were there?
Thank you for the question and for the interest. I tried to to get as much as possible. First, about the budget, the percentage of the budget. To be honest, I don't know about the percentage of the whole budget, which how much is for the police. They increased the budget the last 2 years a lot because we do have problems on security from our perspective, and they increased it like 30% the last 2 years. But to be honest, it also has to do like sometimes with elections. So it's always a good thing for us if elections are coming up. But also you have to have like a trustful statistic, and you have to share it, and they have they have to have a feeling that you tell them the truth and you're not faking. That's very, of course, very important. Talking about the education in general, we don't have a very military education anymore. We did, it's only the little things you need. You need to march, you need to go into a riot or something, but that's everything. You need to know how to handle your weapon, but it's as low as possible if it comes to the military thing. When I was starting, I was marching around for half a year. It was useless. And just to give you an idea, 40 years ago, when I, after my 2 years of education, when I came to the police station, they said, okay, it's nice that you're here. Now forget everything what you learned, so we show you how policing works. Nowadays, it's completely different. Nowadays, we are looking forward to these young guys coming with their new ideas and everything, and very, very good educated. The other thing about the education, ongoing education you were mentioning or asking, it's of course it's long ways to get up in the system, and some are left behind. And you were asking about what kind of consulting you get. We have a lot of possibilities to get seminars during the year. For example, I can go every year to a seminar about leadership. A seminar about leadership, for example, I can bring in my problems, and it's been discussed with professionals from other areas. But talking about leadership, what is also very important, we also have like the leadership seminars for the staff, because if I'm like saying I'm a modern leader and the staff doesn't understand me, but if I ask them something and they say, well, if you don't tell me what to do, I don't do it. So they have to understand the modern leadership. So we also have seminars for these guys of leadership, because they have to understand modern leadership. It's always both sides. It's the staff and the leaders. It has to go together. And also, we do have, for example, supervisions and stuff like this, if you are anything. You said, why are we attractive? Like this. Well, there's one point I really have to be honest. Like the government work right now is attractive, generally, because think about Industry 4.0, digitalization. Nobody knows what's coming in the next 10 years, and here you know you have a secure job. It's a lifetime job. But all out of this, police is the very most attractive one because it's. We have good reputation. If you see that, you don't want to work for a company. You think, I don't want to tell anybody. like for the Secret Service, for example, that's different. You don't want to talk Secret Service, but police. And just also to give you an idea, when I was starting, I told my teachers I'm going to become a policeman. They said, oh, okay, because I want to become a teacher. And then, policeman, oh, are you sure? Why? Mm-hmm. Now it's completely different nowadays. Or when I was talking to students and he's studying this, he's studying this, what are you doing? Policeman, okay, so that was it. Nowadays it's completely different. They ask you and say, well, I'm a detective here and there, oh, it's interesting what you're doing. So it's completely different view on that now. The other thing, if prevention is just an abstract thing, or is it a part of a whole environment? Of course it's a part of the whole environment, and of course it's a big point where you live, how you live, what your circumstances for, what is your education. Education is the most important thing. It's the most important thing for development, and it's the most important thing for how you can manage your life. And of course it's not a police thing. We work together with everybody. We work together with the Minister of Social Affairs very closely when it comes to prevention. We have prevention programs. We work together. For example, in the school, we are not in the curriculum. We're just consulting. We are not, like, police is not teaching there. We go there that they understand us, but we are not teaching there. Maybe Peter comes gives more details, but we are not in the curriculum and we don't teach. We just want to be visible, touchable, and say, this is the police, this is your friend, this is our part. Project Peace Center, of course, something like this would help. I'm not from the Bavarian government. I can't say something if they would do something like that, but of course if they do the right thing, that would help a lot. It's not just the policing, it's not just the pressure. Of course this would help. And what you mentioned about the insurance company, trust is earned, that's completely right. You can't buy it and you can't keep it. As I said, at the end, it's an ongoing process. If I do something, if I say something as a policeman, it's not Mr. Ecker said that, that's the police. And so we have to have, like, look into the whole organization. Every mistake is not a mistake from Ecker, Breitner or Bühler, it's a mistake from the police. And we have to mention this and have to be very careful. Even if we do make mistakes, we have to not hide it, we have to make it open, and we have to look what are the results, and we have to solve it. This is very important on that point. And then the last point about the philosophy, of course it's very important that we are visible. That's the most important thing. You have to be on the street. Like, these guys are not sitting in the office and waiting for a call. They are in the street. You have to be visible. That's very, very important. And one thing about, you talked about this break-in, we had a big problem with burglary the last couple of years. We put a lot of effort in that. For example, one thing, we had a program after not in Munich, but in other city, after the police took the case, did everything, they were investigating, sometimes they get the perpetrator, sometimes not. After 2 or 3 months, there was a policeman coming back to the victim and said, how did you feel about our action? Are you content? What do you think? What could we do better? After this, we came back 3 months later, did a survey, come to you, you have a break-in, we come to you after 3 months and ask you, what did you think about our action? Are you content? Were the policemen friendly? Do you think you are successful? Do you have any suggestions we should do? And this, again, builds a lot of trust on one hand, and on the other hand, we can learn from it. It's not that we know everything, we can learn from it what your needs are, or how you feel.
Some additional information concerning the training. So we need a training for, at the moment, for 2 days, 4 times a year, to avoid critical situation, to handle critical situation, included a training about the behavior, communication, what you do in particular situations. Then I have a rate of 20%, additional 20%, where I can send my 20% of my officers I can yearly to a further training, depending what they need. So we look exactly where is the problem. I explained if we have a problem with communication skills, for example, with one officer, so I send him to a communication seminar. That's outside. But additionally, we have in Munich, 4 times a year for the people, for the officers who are on the streets, a training for practical behavior, how they communicate, how they act, and this is very important for me. About the youth officers and the cooperation, is there a contract or something else, or are we a teacher? No, we are not teachers, but we work together with them. We had a special unit who makes make the sheets for the training. They implement what's necessary, how they can, should talk, what they should implement in the trainings. And this unit trains also teachers. And the teachers work together with our youth officers 1-2 days a year in the several class steps, levels of school. And grades, yes, in the same grades. And for the practice, they are very happy if the police comes. So we have a very good contact, because the school leaders mean that this is very important for them. They have also a problem sometimes with violence or with theft in the schools. And there is a contract, I think it's similar like a contract between the Ministry for Education and the Ministry for Internal Affairs. So that's on the high level, there are contacts that we should do that. So we cannot go as a police station to one school without the allowance or without its permission. With the permission from the headquarters from the ministry.
Okay. People who haven't asked a question at this stage, anybody else? Maybe we're looking for a follow-up. Okay.
Thank you, Chair. Just one or two questions lastly would be, in your line of work in Germany, do you ever encounter cold cases? And normally, what would be your approach to cold cases, and what are your successes in Germany in terms of policing and investigation thereof?
Okay, I just want to add one question to that, but I just want to correct something that might have been a perception about my allusion to the military leadership development. It's got nothing to do with military training. It's got everything to do with addressing a crisis. So identification of leadership and inserting him into the system as quickly as possible, because if we do it on the basis of UDIS, a million people will have died by the generational change it will take in order to insert, to bring about your system, if you get it right. So it's about crisis management. And I would like to urge that that when you do speak to the National Commissioner, that you look at the difference between the South African scenario and the Bavarian scenario at the moment, because you're going to have to do a transitional phase, and that transitional phase is going to have to be a crisis management phase, which includes things like the recruitment and that sort of thing. But I'd just like to ask Mr. Breitner, please, is there some support for your police officers as far as housing is concerned? One of the big problems we have in South Africa is that our police officers often are recruited far away from their place of deployment. So they live maybe 5 or 10 kilometers, if not worse, away from their place of their station precinct. And the ranks of the constable salaries, the lower ranks, their remuneration is not great. And therefore their affordability of housing is very poor. So often you find them living in the same conditions of where the worst crime is prevalent. And therefore them to enforce crime, to enforce law enforcement in those areas while they're still living in that environment is exceptionally difficult. So either they don't want to do it, or else they don't want to live there. But they don't have any alternative. The South African service appears to be getting out of the housing market. They used to have a lot of housing for police officers, and where those that didn't live in supported housing, they gave them generous housing subsidies. Now that has fallen away. I'd like to know what the German system does as far as either housing subsidy support is concerned or alternatively dedicated housing for bachelors and bachelorettes and things of that nature.
It is a problem and a challenge for us. Yes, we have a problem similar. Munich is very expensive to live, and the salary of the young officers are not so much that what I have. And there are some, our commissioner tries to find solution, to find places where can they live, as I said, pay not too much. But the problem is that the police and also the government cannot stop the increasing rates for the living space. And therefore, what we do is every young police officer has to sign that he accepted to live in Munich for a limited of time. And then he can ask to go to the place where he comes from. This is one point. And the other point, I don't know what happened behind. Maybe there's a kind of the trust what we have in the society. In my office, I ask always, do you have a living room when they come from police school to my office? And there was in the last 2 years no officer who said, no, I can't find an apartment for me. So sometimes they do it together. One, they live together in one apartment, for example, and they, after the end of the shift, they go home, well, to their families. But in practice, it isn't a huge problem at the moment. I don't know why exactly. Maybe this is the trust call. The people say, oh, it's better to get a little less income for my apartment, and I have a police officer. So this is what I think very important and is helpful for the officers. They all find an apartment, and they have a much better situation than nurses or other employers of the public administration. But it's a problem.
And to compare the situation between Munich, where you have not an informal settlement, like you have maybe in Janga or Kalica, is very difficult. And the challenges you're facing, you cannot compare to Munich. The problem is that landlords usually like to rent houses to people who earn lots of money. Yeah? And that is the biggest challenge for the Bavarian young police officer.
And what also helpful is we have a good public transport system. By myself, I have 35 kilometers to my office, but it's not a problem for me because the public transport system is very good. This is also helpful for us. So they can live, their officers live in the suburbs of Munich, not all in the city.
And that is maybe interesting because the police officers, correct me if I'm wrong, but they can use the public transport system for free.
Yeah.
And the idea behind that is that you have police officers always in the public transport system to secure it also. So they can travel freely, but they also secure the public transport system.
Yeah, we did try that some years ago and it didn't sell well with Metro Rail. Okay. Sorry, was your question answered, colleague? No.
Yeah, we do have special units for cold cases. There are two different kinds of cold cases. You have, it's not cold cases, but it's cases that are cleared, they are solved, but we don't have the perpetrator, we don't have the suspect. For that, we have targeted fugitive search teams. They don't do anything, just look for those. Wherever in the world, sometimes they are, I don't know, different continents. So we have this, because if you clear a case and you don't have the suspect, that's just not really helpful. On the other hand, we store the cold cases and we always take it out if there is a new technique coming up, like with fingerprints or with the DNA or with face recognition, or if there is new information coming up about this person or this suspect. So both things, so we every other year we take in our hand and try it again. I was heading an old case was over 25 years ago and we had new possibilities in DNA, and so we started all again and investigated another 5 years in that case, and we succeeded at the end. I can't tell about the percentage, but we do have units who take care of cold cases, especially looking at those. And especially we look at the cold cases before.
Like
legal deadline.
Yeah. For most cases, you have a legal deadline to enforce it, and especially before this legal deadline comes, we try again and look if there is any information we could do now before this legal deadline comes up. The clearing rate in murders is some between 95% and 98%.
I think ours is running in single digits just about at the moment. It's a problem. All right. Colleagues, unfortunately our guests have to leave. I want to take this opportunity to thank Mr. Egger and Mr. Breitner and the Hans Seidel Foundation. I see Ms. Barnard has joined us for bringing the two guests to us. It's very good to see our Bavarian twin partners back in South Africa. And hopefully Member Lekka one of these days will be included. Make sure your party includes you on the delegation next time. We'd love to have you there. I'm sure they'd love to send you. Can I ask that we've just got two small tokens of appreciation for our two guests. If Member Kabida could give Mr. Egger this small token, and Member Lekka, if you could give this token to Mr. Breitner, please. Thank you. And thank you very much, and safe travels further on.
Thank you.
Is it not done yet? Docs, who's going to present on behalf of the Department for Youth Safety and Religion Program? The HOD himself.
Thank you
for your time. And that's the Kapalai and Mr. Weinglove. I'm sure that we can fit it in stock. So, Mr. Morris, can I hand over to you immediately and
Chairperson, may I just introduce our team working with the program specifically? Is then Deputy Director Mansoor Lahkar to the right, then the Acting Director for the program partnerships. Strategic partnerships is Mr. Wingrove, and then the chief director responsible for the program is Advocate Pillay. We've got only 6 slides there, mindful of your time, so I'll run through it very quickly, allowing for questions. So the objectives of the Youth Safety and Religious Program, why do we do this? is to provide youth within vulnerable areas, and that's mainly the areas dominated by murder rates and gang activities, with a safe space. Very important. It's about creating a safe space and then involving them in constructive activities during some of the school holiday period. I say some, Chair, because it does not run for the full school holiday period. It run on mostly for a week. How we partnered with the religious fraternity. There are quite a number of them present here, Chair, as well. But we partnered with the religious fraternity because of their well-established footprint in areas with high crime rate, even those with high crime rates. And the reason also is that most of the religious institutions already had youth programs. They run this, so we could just piggyback on the existing programs and amplify what they do and the impact of it. When the YSRP was first piloted in 2012-13 and has since become an annual program included in our APPs and running during the June-July holidays as well as the December-January. Next slide, Chair. That would give you an idea of the 6 years, the spend, the number of youth reached, the number of approved institutions, and bear in mind, Chair, that this is an APP, so it's audited by the Auditor General as well, and we sign an agreement with each of those institutions. You may find that some of the institutions, of course, repeat, so it's the same institutions, and then the number of areas where we run the program, and the total spending. So you'll see over the 6 years, this year is not completed yet, but we have made a total of 22.9 million rand investment. For the 18-19 financial year, Chair, or the one that we're current in, just to give you a breakdown of the June-July, you'll see the total organizations were 96, of which 89 were so-called gang stations. So it's very focused on those problem areas. The next slide is just a process followed, and we gave a bit more detail that may be necessary, but it's just for the panel or for the committee also to understand the process. So we open an advert, we place adverts in community papers, we invite religious organizations to apply for funding. The deadline for December was then the 24th of August. Then we have a panel meeting, adjudication panel, which is made up of the South African Police Services, Community Safety, and CPFs, in some cases, depend on their functionality. And they will adjudicate the applications on the 19th of September, and then the adjudication panel recommendations will be submitted to the accounting officer during the week of 1 and 5 October, and the rest of that you'll then see that the payments we hope to make this year by the 29th of October. The next one, how do we know the programs are taking place, Chair? This is a program that is very high in M&E requirements. So 83% of the programs are visited unannounced, and we keep a detailed assessment of the programs. We also invite CPFs and the SAPs to conduct unannounced visits in their areas, and they do so, but we don't have the detail of their feedback. Chairperson, then also last year we commissioned an impact analysis in the YSRP as part of our impact, which is then adjudicated by the Office of the President, as you know, and these are just then some of the findings, key findings made in that impact study that we did. It was an independent impact study commissioned through the procurement process. The findings, Chairperson, firstly revealed that the program was able to keep children and youth off the street. Secondly, it showed to have good foundation for immediate outcomes of safety. The program, very importantly, experienced zero disruption because of safety concerns in the area. Often in the after schools we see that programs are suspended because there was a shooting and so, yet when we partnered with the religious fraternity, they seem to be resilient enough to actually run the programs despite the turmoil in the communities. They also recommended that we need to be more targeted in our marketing strategies. FBO should be provided with an opportunity to brought together so that they can learn from one another. So part of the research said we need to have these engagements where they can share best practices and design principles. They also recommended that technology update should be made to the Western Cape Government Docs administrative systems. Again, Chair, as you know, our IT systems are not up to speed. There's delays in payments and so forth. These are just some of the practical findings of the evaluation. All of this now goes into an improvement plan, Chairperson, and as part of the MPAT process, we then have to demonstrate that we address these concerns raised during the evaluation function. I think I'll stop there, Chair. That's then the presentation for now.
All right, colleagues, any questions for the report? Mr. Christians, followed by Mr. Leka, followed by Mr. Mitchell, followed by Mr. Kavita. Mr. Christians.
Thank you, Chair. Just a question. I know you said, you know, you're going to get there's a recommendation for best practices. I want to know, is there a targeted approach? You get the children off the streets, but is there a targeted approach? Maybe, you know, especially in your gang-infested areas, of behavior change and those type of things. I'm talking about those type of targeted approaches that when the child leaves, it just was not a fun exercise, but it's something that, you know, this guy, some career guy or something. I want to see if they're targeted approach, because it's one thing to keep them there for the holidays, but they must learn something so that they're better individuals. I'm just thinking that. So I want to know from you, is there a targeted approach, and do you monitor those type of things, or if is it just a program to keep them off the streets? That's my question. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. Chair, Member Mitchell has partly covered my first question because...
Member Christians,
thank you. Because I want to think that the sole purpose of investing these monies is to ensure that you have a youth that is resilient. And if you're talking of resilient, well, that means that on a specific week during school holidays, they're out of the school. But what else? What are the skills that are important on them during that week that they are engaged in a specific project? But also, Chair, key to that question would be, what are the terms of reference, and what is entailed in the memorandum of understanding with these religious fraternities from a view of ensuring that they are safer communities and that the youth involved in those activities is resilient enough? The second question, Chair, which is linked to this also, talks to the opportunities that are brought into the religious fraternities by the department in ensuring that there is a strategic partnership to other churches. Do you reach out to other religious fraternities, or what's the method of recruiting these fraternities? And also targeting on the gang areas. You've got 89 areas that have been targeted. What are the desirable outcomes with the investment of the money? I'll make an example. There was an investment by the city of Cape Town on Operation Fire, somewhere in Hanover Park. But that actual site was somewhere in Strandfontein. And I want to check what has been the desirable outcomes in this investment on the gang strategies? Did we receive the outcomes? Is it work in progress? Is there a percentage that we can say with the involvement of the religious structures in area A or area B, we have seen a decrease in 1 to 3, or there's been a stable recruitment of gangsters? Youth is not involved, or what is happening? Is there a research study conducted based on the activities by these religious structures? The last one, Chair, would be around the issue of monitoring by the department to these religious structures. What exactly is the department monitoring on this? Is it the fact that last year there were 30 youth that attended, this year we've seen an increase of 10 students, or is it a matter of a detailed development in those learners? Is there research conducted on those attendees themselves as to if they have achieved the necessary skills as desired by the creation of a safer community? Lastly, key to that also in terms of monitoring and evaluation, is the department going to add some aspect in terms of the monitoring in the current monitoring tool that it has on those religious structures?
Thank you, Chair. Let me firstly welcome the presentation. I just want to touch on the evaluation findings, and let me from the offset say that as long as if we can have children off the streets, the program and development can come later. I mean, that safe space it's important to create, and it takes me back to from the community where I grew up, where on a Friday night, as a 16-17-year-old boy, we knew that going to youth on a Friday night will create that safe space in a gang-stricken environment. So that wasn't too long ago. I'm not disputing that there needs to be a proper program and development, but the initial getting the children off the street and into a safe space is very welcome. I just want to, on that, say that the findings is that the content of program or holiday programs need to be carefully designed. So with the deadline being June, July for the different fraternities, how are you going to be able to have that synced to the applications of these various fraternities? Because obviously it changes annually, and I would imagine that not the same people will be assisted.
Thank you, Chair. I'm referring to my own constituency, Tigerberg 1. That is a really crime-infested area. Secondly, looking at the religious fraternity, I know about, personally, a second chance people who were previously involved in gangster activities, and they've made a total turnaround and turnabout in terms of conversion and being involved in religious activities in the true sense of the word. I know them and I work with them. So these people know the dynamics of crime. They know the ground intelligence, and they know the people, etc. So what they bring to the table is really resilience. And a final question, what is the possibility of deploying some of these people because of their skills, their expertise, experience, and their guts and their will, and also the respect that they and trust that they have in the communities, in our hotspot areas, in the base camps, for instance. just for the sake of visibility. Thank you so much, Chair.
Okay, thank you. Before I ask the department to answer those questions, can I just ask in the audience here, are there any service providers that are providing for this program at the moment? Just that one gentleman. I don't know whether you'd like to, after the department's had a chance to answer, if you'd just like to give us your impressions as to the efficacy of the program just for a minute or two, I'd appreciate it if you can come sit in the bench at the end there. Thanks. Department.
Chairperson, going back to Honourable Member Christian's question, in terms of targeted approach and whether we build in elements of behavioural change. Again, Chairperson, I think we just need to do a bit of a comparison. If we look at, for instance, Chrysalis, where there's a lot of focus on behavioural change, the cost there is about 38,000 rand per youngster. Here we work with a budget of less than 200 rand per youngster. So again, it is about what is affordable. Do we use the money, if you look at the table, Chairperson, do we use the money to keep 108,000 kids off the street, or do we use the money maybe for 8,000 kids to have behavioral change? So this program is very much about creating a safe space. And again, because we piggyback on the programs of the religious fraternity, we don't have absolute control over the content of the programs. Because remember, as I said, these are programs run already by the religious fraternity. We give a subsidy of 50 rand a day, and there's a requirement that the meal must be provided. So you can see there's really no money. Honourable Member Christians, I do honestly believe that the religious fraternity, their whole core business is about behavioural change and so forth. So just the exposure to that environment. As Member Mitchell said, and I'm going to jump to that question again, the evaluation said we need to be more involved in the program design. We won't be able to do it for this program, but there is now an improvement plan that will run over 2 or 3 years in terms of our ability to prescribe and again have probably more strategic partnerships. But again, the difficulty is one can go to the mainstream church groups, but they don't necessarily have the footprint in the really the poorer of the poor. So we err on the side of and our subsidies, Mr. Lakar, is capped at about 16,000 rand per program. Can you what's the cap on the programs?
In terms of the allocation, obviously it's 50 rand per youth per day. And it varies depending on the amount of requests that are made from the organization that we do fund. But we do cap it at an amount between 16 and 21,000 depending on where the program are running. So if it is in a high priority area, actually, then it receives a bigger amount compared to a lesser priority area. Not saying that there isn't an importance there.
Again, Chair, I just wanted to illustrate that it's actually small amounts of money. You know, a project being capped at 21,000 rand for the week is not a lot of money on that basis. Coming back, I think I've answered to some question, the questions asked by Honourable Member Lekker as well. On the terms of reference, I'll ask Mr. Lakar again to refer on that. Let me just go into the areas, ma'am. It's not 89 areas. It is 89 institutions. The gang areas are 26, and that is determined by the police. And once when I asked the provincial commissioner, how do you determine it, they said the areas put themselves onto the list because of the amount of activities and murders and so forth. The desirable outcomes, how do we measure it? I think I've alluded to that. Our measurement at this stage is really just to make sure that the agreement, if we sign an agreement for 30 kids for 5 days, we go and make sure that they are there, that the space is safe, that they're not playing somewhere on a pavement or whatever, and that they are provided a meal. So that's the extent of our monitoring. As I said, we do not yet go into the detail of the content of the programs. Mr. Lakar, if you can maybe on the terms of reference. the requirements?
Yes, so each FPO that is approved has to sign a memorandum of agreement. In that agreement, it specifies what amount is being issued and what are the targets that should be reached by the particular organization. So, for example, if the organization was approved for a certain amount of money, it will specify that the organization has to reach 60 kids over a period of 5 days in that particular area. It also has to it also spells out that there should be a suitable venue that is arranged in place for the activity to take place. In addition, also that for each there should be a facilitator for every 20 youths that is at the event, so that we ensure that there is adequate supervision over the youth or the children that attends the activity for the period of 5 days. We also have another clause in the terms of reference that says, or in the MOA, that there should be an indemnity form for each child that attends the activity. In that way, we want to make sure that the parent or guardian of that particular child is fully aware and has given permission, and that that responsibility rests with the entity that has been given approval to ensure that the indemnity forms are signed. So that when the monitors go out and they go and do a check, they also have to check on the attendance registers, which is displayed at the particular venue where the activities are running, asking a particular question from the organization: did you issue the indemnity forms, and has it been signed and received by the particular parent or guardian?
Maybe in conclusion, in terms of us trying to respond to all the questions, Chair, I think the question of deploying some of the youth workers, it is something that we're looking at after the report. Again, maybe some of the youth workers can be put on a stipend payment and continue with the program throughout. But that there's still a lot of permissions and so that we need to get. But I think that's what Mr. Kividu was suggesting, and we will look into that further.
Okay. Thank you very much, Mr. Pond. Gentlemen, would you like to just give your impressions with regard to the program? It's up to you.
Yes.
Just come and sit in the chair there. Is it there, Chair? While he's just getting ready, I just want to say to the department, you made the comparison just now with regard to cost spend as far as Chrysalis versus this sort of program. And it's one of the observations that I've made over the last couple of years, and that is that Chrysalis has become a job creation scheme. It was never intended as a job creation scheme. It was intended as a force multiplier to develop youth leaders to go into the community to run exactly these sort of products. Job creation was a byproduct because the project was so successful. It's something you're going to have to look at, because you're training at great cost really highly motivated people who have got a skill set, and the skill set's not being utilized in many respects. They're doing well, they're getting taken up in employment and that sort of stuff, but they have got a skill set, and that is as youth leaders. And they could add an enormous capacity to, whether it is youth development, whether it is church groups, whether it is service organizations, that's where they're meant to be located. That's a secondary byproduct. Yes, sir. Will you just introduce yourself and tell us what your experiences are of the program, please?
Thank you, Honorable Chairman, and the entire committee here. Thank you so very much for this opportunity. And once again, I'm Reverend Samuel Dean from Yeshua Covenant Church, and I'm the chairman and the CEO, a senior pastor at Yeshua Covenant Church. Our organization has been in partnership with the department since 2013. So we've come a long way with the department, and we've established a very good relationship. Regarding the program, I would say that the program is basically a partnership between government, particularly community safety, and the religious institutions. The partnership is, I believe, is necessary to help change the perception of the community on regarding government, how government operates, and whether government cares or not regarding crime and the ills in our communities. And so I would say that it helps to change the perception of the community, and it also brings government to the ground level of the people, especially regarding safety and security. From my personal experience, our organization is highly community-driven. We are fully compliant with government. We are registered as a public benefit organization. We are registered as a non-profit organization. And over the past years, we have reached lots and lots of youth and children. Even though the department policy has changed in terms of restriction regarding the number of beneficiaries, nonetheless, our organization continues to reach thousands of youth and children. The attendance register, the photograph, media report, video clip proves these claims. In June, just before I left for the United States for a conference in Greensboro, we reached 1,088 youth and children over the 5 days period. There's evidence to prove it. We have youth and children coming from townships like Blokumbus. The photograph, we have photograph once again to prove these claims. They come to Scottsville where I am busy, where I've been busy for the past 5 years with the department. And so we run various programs. We work in partnership with an organization called Standing Rock that caters for boys in drugs and gangsterism. So apart from the religious program we run, we are also involved in helping to rehabilitate youth, particularly boys in drugs and gangsterism, in using Reflector. We have a center there. And we've been involved with this since 2014. And so the little support we get from your department, Honorable Chairman, is needed. It has been helpful. It has helped enable us to expand our program and to become more efficient in trying to bring about change in our communities. I also serve on the board of the CPF, the Community Policing Forum of Kraaifontein. Our recent meeting in partnership with the police, it was reported that the community that I service, particularly Scottsville, has been very quieted in recent times when it comes to drugs and gangsterism. And Scottsville has been one of the communities where you have ongoing gang violence and murder. And so I would like to say the program has been very helpful. Whereas the program is good, one of your staff mentioned regarding what is the objective of the program, what is it really achieving. Look, we provide, basically we bring in experts, we bring in partners from the Early Childhood Development Directorate, social workers, we bring in the police to come in and assist us provide some information regarding crime prevention, the danger, the risk of school dropout, teenage pregnancy, drugs and gangsterism, and how it can negatively affect the future of our youth and children. So we bring in the experts every time we run the program, and it has been very helpful. So we don't just bring people to entertain them. While we are entertaining to attract them, we also use the opportunity to empower them with information, knowledge, and skill set, especially the children. We engage them using our own staff that have been trained, that work with our children's church. For example, we bring in artwork focusing on the children. We separate the little children from the youth. While we engage in the youth, for example, in the hall,
particularly in my community, we have an area that is very secure, and we have the little children outside jumping castle. We have people guiding them, protect the environment. And we do recruiting, just to let you know, we do recruiting through our traditional marketing, like posters, social media. And we use radio, we use the media. We work with the Tiger Burger, and we have a long-standing relationship. So I want to say, Honorable Chairman, and to this committee, that your support to us has been very helpful to us, and we appreciate it a lot.
Pastor, thank you very much. You certainly took use of that opportunity, and it's, I don't know whether you planted him there as a witness testimony, but he did a very good sales job for you. So Pastor, just for your information, we oversight over the executive, and the executive makes the money available for the department, and our job is to make sure that the money is well spent, so you've given a good indication that in your particular case it appears to be well spent. Thank you very much for that.
Thank you, Honourable.
All right, folks, what's it? Okay. All right, then, are there any other closing remarks from your side, Mr. Morris?
I'm mindful of your time. Just one. In the alcohol harms reduction, we did extensive research now on what are the preferred activities of communities. And again, religion came out extremely strong in many of our poor communities, especially for women and for children. We are the only department currently making any kind of investment into the religious fraternity, and I do believe they are contributing significantly to the stabilization and to the crime prevention or safety promotion in communities. Thank you, Chair.
Yeah, well, it's the single biggest scourge we have at the moment, single biggest cause of unnatural death in the country, I think it is, as far as the stats are concerned. All right, thank you very much to the HOD and the department, and also to the public for assisting that. Can I ask that we go into committee, please, just to do our resolutions and recommendations? I think there are some snacks at the back there, or drink, or whatever it is. So thank you very much. Thank you. Okay, if you could just stay behind so we could just conclude our administration and agree upon the way forward. Just get from the committee side, please, any feelings about the first presentation, which is from the Bavarian police. Are there any recommendations or resolutions you'd like to take in that regard, or is it just for noting? Okay. Member Decker?
No, thank you, Chair. Chair, I would love to perhaps get a